If you're not familiar with Rupert Sheldrake, well, you should be, and he'll be on live from London in just a few minutes. His book, one of his books we're offering is Morphic Resonance, The Nature of Formative Causation. Deepak Chopra says, Rupert Sheldrake's contributions will be recognized one day at the same level of those of Newton and Darwin. So that's the level of person that we've got.
Boy.
And that's from Deepak Chopra and a lot of other people. This is one of the great leading-edge science thinkers on the planet. Very controversial. The head of Nature magazine said his book should be burned. So he's created a lot of controversy. And we have him here live from London in just a couple minutes. We're just waiting for a few more pledges come in. Call 265-9555, 1-800-355-KVMR. Become a new member. Become a part of the family. Become an angel. Come on the air with me. You know, we'll let me know who you want on the show. We'll get them here.
Angel, of course, is a person who makes $1 a day contribution to KVMR, $30 a month, more or less. And that's something that you could very conveniently have taken from your bank account or charged to your credit card each and every month. And that way it makes a significant contribution to us. But it also, it shows your determination to support independent media, to support cutting edge and thinking that is ahead of the curve right here on shows like Conversations. 265-9555 in the 530 area code, or 800-355-5867. Michael, do we, just before we go, what sort of thank you gifts do we have from
for this show? Like I said, we had the book by Rupert Sheldrake. That's Morphic Resonance, and we have 12 copies of that available, although the phones are ringing, so
call in. And you get your choice of if you want to burn it, you can.
You can burn it.
You
That's
could
right.
if you wanted to.
Yeah.
Or you might
read it first.
You might want to share it with some other people.
Also, I'm going to edit this particular upcoming interview of Rupert Sheldrake, and I have a 2-CD set of interviews I did in Bolivia, including Father Descoto Brockman. You can be an angel, you can be a good Samaritan and just send in a few $1,000. We could use it, and we really, really do appreciate your support. One way to support is listening. Another way to support is involvement. And this is your community and your opportunity to be involved. I love the Global Citizens Package. That's where a portion of your money goes to the food bank, to Tennessee Food Relief, to Haiti, and to Chile Earthquake Relief. And that's $150 to pledge for a global citizen. Or you can get a flood relief, Tennessee Flood Relief, 6 lifeboats for $365. Or you can get 6 life baskets to Haiti or Chile for $365. So,
Michael, we also want to remind people that, as you just were saying, and maybe you can repeat this offer, is that if you really enjoyed that last interview, and I suspect you did, you can get a copy of that interview,
right.
and that's part of what package, just, so that folks out there know.
That's part of the 2-CD set that I will be personally recording and sending to people. That's only one of the 3 or 4 interviews that will be on that.
And those are all, those were from your visit to Bolivia.
That's from Bolivia, but some of the leading edge thinkers. Cormac Cullen will be there, the head minister of state from Ecuador is on it, Descoto Brockman from the UN. So it's a pretty high level set of interviews that you'll get, and very inspiring also.
So if you want to get a copy of that last interview that we heard with the president, the former president of the UN General Assembly, the person who's reimagining the UN, you can get that as part of the Bogota package that Michael is offering. And that's at what level? A minimum gift?
That's at $60.
$60
for that.
A $60 gift and a 2-CD set of interviews
and
from
I'll
Bolivia.
Be personally printing them.
And so that's something you can get right now. Move to your phones, 530-265-9555, 800-355-5867. We're going to be putting you on the honor system here in just a few minutes because Michael's going to be talking live live from London with somebody who's written a book that some people think should be burned. How about that? And you're going to be maybe your ears will be getting burned. I don't know. We'll find out.
Steve,
over the next
why don't
hour.
You talk for a minute while I try to get through to London?
Okay.
Here. We're calling him live in London.
Okay, we'll do that. And by the way, speaking of good causes, Anyone who makes a gift of $30 or more during our membership drive will be entered in a drawing for a $2,000, it's called a Project Rwanda Coffee Cargo Bike. And what this is it is, you'll find out more about it tomorrow on Bike Talk, exactly 24 hours from now. They're on from 1 to 2 this Wednesday, a special Bike Talk for you. But this, a very creative, U.S. bicycle designer. I think one of the inventors of the mountain bike, Tom Ritchie, has a company that has been building these cargo bikes, for people in Rwanda to help them be able to take coffee from one place to another, because they lack roads, they lack pickup trucks, they lack all sorts of things that would make it that we take for granted here. There they can take a huge amount of coffee on this cargo bike along with another passenger, and so this has been one of Tom Ritchie's ways of making things better in Rwanda, and obviously that's partially financed by sales of bikes here in the United States. And so we've got this exclusive one, and it can be yours. Anybody who makes a gift of $30 or more is automatically entered into the drawing for it. So your chances are pretty good. That's going to be, you know, one in probably less than 1,000. 265-9555 in the 530 area code, or 800-355-5867. And you don't have to say anything about it. Again, $30 gift or higher, and you are in that drawing. No questions asked. There are alternate means of entry, including sending KVMR a postcard to enter. And those rules are at KVMR's website at kvmr.org. 265-9555 in the 530 area code. Back to Michael.
Well, Steve, I am very thrilled because we have Rupert Sheldrack live from London on the air. And Rupert is a very special. We talked about you a minute ago, Rupert, and said that the editor of Nature wanted to burn your book. But he's an English biochemist and a plant physiologist. He's known for having proposed a non-standard account of morphogenesis and for his research into parapsychology. Rupert's books and papers stem from the theory of morphic resonance and cover topics such as animal and plant development and behavior, memory, telepathy, perception, and cognition in general. I've got Rupert on the air. Are you there, Rupert Sheldrake?
I am, yes.
Oh, good. Okay, so, well, let's just start out talking about what the name of your book is, Morphic Resonance, the Nature of Formative Causation. Let's just start out with a little operating definition of morphic resonance and morphogenetic field so we can get into this conversation.
Morphic resonance is a process whereby similar patterns of activity influence subsequent similar patterns of activity. And that's within self-organizing systems, including atoms, molecules, crystals, cells, animals, plants. It's really a kind of collective memory theory. It basically says that if you train rats to learn a new trick in California, then rats all over the world will learn the same thing quicker just because the rats have learned it in California. So it means that every species has a kind of collective memory. And in its most general sense, it says that the so-called laws of nature are more like habits, that there's a memory in the whole cosmos. The whole of nature has a memory.
Well, I can see how someone might think who is deeply entrenched in a mechanistic perspective of the, quote, laws of nature would want to burn your book. That would turn the world quite upside down, because these laws have, throughout science, been somewhat immutable. How does this affect the general idea of a law of nature? Because this is an evolutionary process, then, based on continuing and building habits.
That's right. Well, you see, the idea of laws of nature made sense when science got going in the 17th century, because people believed that after the universe was created, and all the leading scientists then were Christians and thought it was created by God, that the total amount of matter and energy stayed the same forever, and the laws that governed it, the God-given laws, stayed the same because they were part of God's nature, who was, and he was eternal. So the idea of fixed laws, and indeed the very concept of law, implies a political metaphor. God was like a kind of cosmic emperor giving laws and acted as a universal law enforcement agency. Very anthropocentric metaphor. But we now have a radically evolutionary worldview. We have the idea of a Big Bang about 14 billion years ago, the universe expanding and developing ever since. Everything in the universe is evolving. Human beings, animals and plants, all life, planets, galaxies, the entire universe is evolutionary. So does it any longer make sense to say that it's all governed by fixed laws of nature, that we're all there at the moment of the Big Bang, like a kind of cosmic Napoleonic code? And that's the assumption, you see, and I think the standard assumption that most scientists have, that the laws of nature are fixed, and indeed that they're laws, is not something they've thought about. It's just a habit of thinking that they're so used to, they don't challenge it. But the minute you bring it into consciousness, you realize that it's a bad idea, law, and also the idea that they're all fixed forever just doesn't fit with an evolutionary universe. Laws, in fact, evolve. American laws, British laws, all laws evolve. So even if we want a law metaphor, it would imply evolution of laws. But I think a much better metaphor than law is habit. So what I'm suggesting really is that nature has habits, not laws.
So these habits then, you know, in one place, in I think The Rebirth of Nature, one of your books, you talked about that we couldn't look at the world as purposeless anymore. Do these habits form what you're thinking of in terms of a purpose in the evolutionary path, or how do you get to that place of that there's some purpose in this?
Well, I mean, there's two different senses of purpose. One is the local sense of purpose, the limited sense of purpose. A bird builds a nest in order to lay eggs in it. The mother and father bird feed the young so they can grow up and leave the nest and become independent birds and so forth. A dog goes across the room when it sees a bone because it wants to eat the bone. There are lots of things in nature that show purpose. But these are not necessarily to do with the overall purpose of evolution. These are limited purposes.
Uh-huh.
And I think that all living organisms have purposes. They're all purposive. They all work towards goals or ends. And we do ourselves. That's why we have motives, purposes, intentions. So there's a sense of purpose in that everything in nature has purposes. But they're usually repetitive purposes. A donkey trying to copulate with another donkey has a purpose. It wants to copulate, and then they give rise to young donkeys, and they do the same. So there's a sense in which these are repetitive, generation after generation. And most of nature has repetitive purposes, including most humans. As each new generation grows up, they have the same kinds of purposes as their parents. Most people want to have a partner, have children, get a job, that kind of thing. So these are not original purposes. They're not creative purposes, and they can be interpreted creatively, but essentially they're repetitive. Now, that is very clear, and I think the whole of nature and all forms of life show purpose. But there's another question as to whether the entire evolutionary process has a purpose. The standard view is that it's just blind chance. Now, I don't think that's very plausible, but it's not obvious if the evolutionary process has a purpose, what that purpose is. For example, if a lot of people would like to think the purpose of life on Earth is the evolution of human beings, but if that's the purpose of life on Earth, then why do you need a million species of beetles along the way and all the other forms of life that we're rapidly causing to go extinct? Why is life so prolific? I think, in fact, any interpretation of the purpose of biological evolution has to have shared diversity as one of the purposes, not just moving towards a goal of producing human beings and Americans and British and that sort of thing. I mean, 14 billion years of cosmic evolution, I don't think, have been directed simply towards the production of the modern British Parliament or American high school. So I think that there's, even if we think there's a purpose in evolution, what is it? And that's not, as I say, it's not immediately obvious. And most traditional religions, of course, see the purpose as something to do with human beings and human consciousness. And I indeed think that is a major part of the purpose of evolution. But it can't be the only purpose, because otherwise why do we need billions of galaxies and star systems, hundreds of millions of star systems, even in our own galaxy, and no doubt billions of planets? It seems enormously prolific, and no simple purpose suffices to explain it.
So I guess one way to say that would be the difference between an inherent purpose and a kind of destinal resolve or a destiny kind of thing that we,
yes,
that is continually unfolding and becoming. And I just to clarify it for people, we're talking about this for all living systems, from a crystal to a galaxy, right? When we're talking about the whole issue of these morphogenetic fields. One of the areas that I'm particularly interested in hearing about, and I think our listeners would be too, is the complete shift in the view of memory that you have, and how it becomes non-local when you look at it from the idea of morphic resonance. Can you talk about that?
Yes. Well, you see, morphic resonance is to do with similarity and a resonance across time from similar things in the past. Now, I was explaining a little while ago that each species has a kind of collective memory, that all members of the species are similar to previous members of the species and are influenced by them, by morphic resonance. But the more similar, the greater the influence. And when you look at people and you say which people are most similar to each other, then the answer would be identical twins. And identical twins on this theory would have a very strong morphic resonance, which would explain why, even when separated soon after birth, they have remarkable coincidences and similarities in their lives that go way beyond what one could reasonably explain in terms of genes and genetic programming. Now, if you ask the question, what person in the past was most similar to me, then the answer has to be myself. I'm more similar to me in the past, and yours more similar to you in the past than you are to anybody else. And that means the most specific resonance acting upon us from the past will be from our own pasts. And that specific self-resonance is, I think, the basis of memory. And it means that we tune into ourselves in the past when we retrieve our memories. Of course, the conventional view that we've all been brought up to believe is that the memories are stored as memory traces somewhere inside the brain.
Yeah.
But of course, despite more than 100 years of trying to find them, people have been extraordinarily unsuccessful in locating these memories. We know that bits of the brain become active when you're laying down memories. They become active when you're retrieving them. But in between, the memories just seem to disappear. And even the most reductionist of brain researchers, like Eric Kandel, who got a Nobel Prize for it, admit that we just simply don't know how long-term memory storage works. Attempts to find it in the brain have failed over and over and over again. And I think the reason is very simple. They're not there, and that's why we can't find them. So this does indeed lead to a completely different view of memory and how memory works.
Now, I'm assuming that's what led you into your experiments and investigations into psi phenomena with the telephone ringing and we know who it is and the dogs and their owners. You wrote a whole book about that and how IQ tests tend to continue, or are continuing to go up, and the being stared at. Can you talk about your research in that area and what you're looking for and what you're finding?
Yes, well, I mean, this covers a huge field, of course. But let's start with telepathy. I think that all animal social groups have what I call morphic fields. It's the field that links together the parts of a system. So a flock of birds and a school of fish are really field phenomena. And when the flock of birds turns suddenly and the birds don't bump into each other, or when a school of fish suddenly changes direction, I think we're seeing the effect of the field of the group on the individuals within it. Now, all social animals, including humans, have fields of the group, morphic fields of the group. And, for example, a pack of wolves. When a pack of wolves splits up, when the young are left behind in a den and the adults go out hunting, the field of the group isn't broken. It stretches. The adults don't forget about the young the minute they go out hunting. In fact, they've gone out hunting to collect food for the young. So the bonds between them are not broken. They simply stretch. And I think of them as rather like an invisible elastic band that connect together members of the group at a distance. This is analogous to a process in physics that probably you've talked about on your program, quantum entanglement. When particles have been part of the same system, if they separate, they go off in different directions. They can even be miles apart. They remain linked to each other, or entangled, as quantum physicists say. So a change in one instantly affects the other. And I'm suggesting that members of social groups, when they separate, like wolves going hunting, leaving the cubs in the den, remain entangled at a distance, linked through the morphic field, so that a change in one affects the other. And I think that link through the morphic field of the group at a distance is what gives rise to telepathy. I think that's how it works. And so I think telepathy is a normal means of communication or connection between separated members of animal groups. It happens between animals that are bonded to each other as part of the same group. So I think telepathy, from this point of view, is something you'd expect to happen, and you'd expect to find it throughout the animal kingdom. That is why I first got interested in telepathy. And I got interested first in animals. Then I found that people had done very, very little work on animal telepathy, and hardly any work on telepathy anyway, because it's a kind of taboo topic within science. So I started investigating telepathy between animals and other animals, and more easily investigating telepathy between animals and people. And I started with the animals we know best, like dogs and cats and horses and parrots. I found that many people have found that their dogs or cats pick up their intention. A lot of people have found that the dog or cat knows when they're coming home, for example. The people at home see the dog go and wait at a door or window, and it gives a kind of signal as to when the absent person is going to arrive. In a lot of households where people have irregular patterns, no routine, the people at home know when the absent person's coming because the animal, as it were, tells them by going and waiting. And this can happen 10 minutes, half an hour or more before the person comes home. This is a thing I've done a lot of research on, and I summarize this research in my book, Dogs That Know When Their Owners Are Coming Home and Other Unexplained Powers of Animals. And, of course, we've looked into the possibility that dogs that know when people are coming home do it by routine or by smell or by hearing familiar car sounds and so forth. But it isn't any of those things, at least for some dogs. It's much more than that. It happens when people come home at randomly chosen times. It happens when they come home in taxis or other unfamiliar vehicles. It happens when the people at home don't know they're coming. It happens when they're coming from more than 5 miles away, far beyond the range of smell of a dog. The most sensitive smelling dogs can only smell people up to half a mile away. So I'm pretty sure that what we're looking at is something that's telepathic. And the most sensitive dogs do this when the person decides to come home, before they've even got into the car or taxi to come home. Everything fits with the idea it's telepathic. And as I say, we've done repeated experiments, controlled experiments, videotaping the dogs continuously. And all this research is published in peer-reviewed journals. And anyone interested in the details and the statistics can find all the papers on my website, www.sheldrake.org. Or just easier, look at the book, Dogs That Know When Their Owners Are Coming Home.
And great website, lots of good information on there. Again, www.sheldrake.org. You know, I when I first started looking at this, I thought that these morphogenic fields were like separate for humans or separate for dogs, or that they were all these. But now I'm curious about the merging of these different fields in different animals, but also perhaps we were just talking with Father Descota Brockman about you know, the being a part of nature and how we have risen, hold ourselves above nature, as we were talking also. And I'm just wondering how much the influence of plants, is there any aspect of the plant world that has perhaps, you know, I mean, plants grow when they're sang to. There was older experiments back in the 60s of that, or playing classical music. How do we cross over in these different fields, and how does that happen?
Well, I haven't done any research on people's relationships with plants to see how they influence plants. It's rather harder to do than with animals. There was some famous research done by Cleve Baxter, who was a CIA lie detector operator, who found that electrical currents changed in plants when people approached them with different emotions. The problem is with that as soon as you start looking at electrical currents, there's lots of electrical currents in plants. It's very hard to disentangle the signal from the noise, and then you're immediately bogged down in a whole technical discussion about what the apparatus means, the artifacts it could generate, and so forth. Whereas when you're working with animals, it's much easier. A dog goes and sits at a door or a window. You don't need complicated interpretation or fancy apparatus. You can just see it, and you can videotape it. So I've concentrated on our interactions with animals, because we form social bonds with animals. Of course, we have interactions with plants, many of them, and gardening, at least in Britain, is the most popular of all hobbies. And even people who haven't got gardens, many of them have houseplants. So certainly all of us, or most of us, have a relationship to plants. Of course, we have it through the fact that we depend on them for our food, but most people want a personal relationship with plants they grow or keep in their house. But this is a very unexplored area, and I haven't explored it much myself either.
You know, mainly looking at the closed anthropocentric way of thinking that we have and how to break out of that. One of the things that we talked about earlier a little bit was, as these habits build within the morphic fields, as they build, they then are shaping the behavior of, say, if we're looking at the human system, they're shaping us. So if we look at the behavior that we have right now in terms of environmental social justice, or the direction we're going in with the climate and things like that, we're on a destruction path. And and yet on the other hand, when you look at the learning within that takes place within the field, the idea that people take IQ tests and they continually get higher because in the field more people understand the answers. Somewhere in that, I'm looking to see for a place of hope for us to shift the direction as a global community and as local communities in the direction we're going. Do you see or have you thought much about the impact of behavioral change in this?
Yes. Well, morphic resonance is good news and bad news. It's bad news in the sense that what it says is that deep-seated habits are hard to change, and that most of our behavior and most of animal behavior and most of the behavior of nature is habitual. These are deep-seated habits. On the other hand, most animals and people change their habits if they have to, and new patterns of behavior can emerge when old habits are interrupted or blocked. And by morphic resonance, new habits can spread faster than they might otherwise. So this does give an accelerated transformation potential. So I think it's good news in the sense that it means changes can happen faster. But of course, not all changes going on in the world at the moment are good changes. And the most important change that's happening on the biggest scale is the conversion of hundreds of millions of people, if not billions of people, all over the world to Western-style habits of consumerism, you know, with commercial television, advertising, and all the things that have spread from Europe and America to the rest of the world. So hundreds of millions of Chinese are now getting cars, and they didn't have them before, and hundreds of millions of Indians. They're just copying us. They're adopting our habits, and obviously the planet can't sustain everybody living in that kind of way. On the other hand, you know, when people's habits are blocked, most people, I mean, one of the things that strikes me over and over again is how adaptable people are when their habits are blocked. And one of the things that's been rather striking here in Europe recently is because of the Icelandic volcano, air flights in Britain and Northern Europe now depend literally on the way the wind's blowing. There were, on Sunday, all flights were blocked out of Heathrow. They're okay, I think, today. You know, the minute the wind veers around, they'll get blocked again. We had a period of 5 or 6 days when there were no flights over Britain at all. Lots of people were stranded. We had some people staying with us who couldn't go. And suddenly, everything changed. We stopped taking for granted that you could fly anywhere when you want. We became much more aware of how dependent we are on the weather and the wind. And a lot of people who were stopped from traveling actually had rather a good time. Some were immensely frustrated, but some adapted and had unexpected breaks, holidays, time that they hadn't planned for. So I think people adapt very quickly, and I think the main reason that people are going to change is not through exhortation to be more responsible. We've had that for years, and it's had very little influence on most people's behavior. People will change when they have to change, and people are going to have to change because business as usual is not going to go on much longer.
Yes, that's true. Unfortunately, it often takes a disaster like the Gulf or like a volcano or earthquake or things like that to get people to make the changes. But that may be a response to a natural response of the Earth, even in response to our degradation of the life support systems.
Could be. I mean, there's no way of knowing that. But I mean, it's certainly, there have always been disasters, earthquakes, volcanic eruptions, etc. But I think we're more vulnerable to them now because we've got this highly sensitive technology. I mean, in the past, it wouldn't have affected people in Britain much if there was a volcanic eruption in Iceland. But now it has a huge effect on the whole of our airspace. And because planes are blocked, then all the trains are full, boats are crowded with people, and so forth. It changes everything now.
I mean, wouldn't you know, the Earth system or the cosmic system just be a macro expression of what you're talking about in the morphogenetic fields and morphic resonance?
Well, I think they are. I think the Earth has a morphic field. I think Gaia, the living Earth, is a kind of living organism. I mean, that's now a fairly common view since James Lovelock put forward the Gaia hypothesis. And so I think, yes, that the Earth is like a living organism. What we don't know is, you know, whether it's more like a plant, more like an animal, or more like a kind of super person. We don't know how the mind of the Earth works or how conscious the Earth is. I mean, plants, after all, are living organisms, but they don't have the same kind of consciousness as we do. So what we have no idea as to the nature of the mind of Gaia.
Yeah, one of the things we were just talking about in the last show was about how someone in, I think it was in the Ecuadorian parliament, said we can't give rights to nature because nature has no voice. And Father Brockman's response to that was, that's like saying that you know, my elbow gets hurt and it can't speak for itself. Of course it can speak for itself because I can speak for itself just as a part of nature. We can speak for the earth and for the rights of Mother Earth. And I think that's, that kind of systems approach is one of the ways we need to shift our thinking in some way.
Mm.
That also brings me to another area that I'm thinking about, Rupert, and that's the area of spirituality and religion. I know that in your earlier life you were either agnostic or atheist, and then you went to India and spent time with Father Bede Griffith, who is the founder of Vandana Inspired Wisdom Christianity. Can you talk a little bit about your conversion, particularly in the relationship of the merging of your scientific view with your spiritual and religious points of view?
Well, yes. I mean, it was a long process, so I'll have to sort of condense it. But when I was being educated in science at school and at Cambridge, here in Britain, it was more or less taken for granted that scientists are atheists. Most scientists are atheists here in Britain. It's less so in America, but in Europe, there's a very high degree of atheism or agnosticism among scientists and indeed among intellectuals. And so it was like a package deal. So I didn't think about it that much. I just was I absorbed this kind of worldview. It went with the scientific way of thinking, which is very mechanistic. But it didn't take me long to see that there was something wrong with this. The first thing was vivisection of animals. I went into biology because I loved animals, and then I found myself vivisecting them. And I found that very, very provoking of thought. I mean, well, why was I doing this? Why, in biology, the science of life, why was it that the first thing we did was to kill things, or at least to cut them up while they were still alive? So that made me think, and it made me stand back a bit, and I got interested in philosophy of science, which I studied at Harvard, and history of science, and that gave me a bigger perspective, and I saw that science, the mechanistic theory, is not a truth, an eternal truth. It's just a paradigm, a model of reality that happens to be dominant at the moment, but needn't be forever. So that was the first doubt. I began to doubt dogmatic materialism, which is what most atheists believe. Most atheists don't believe nothing. They're usually total believers in a kind of materialistic worldview. So that was the first doubt. The second doubts really came through traveling in Asia. I worked in Malaya for a year on tropical rainforest plants, and traveling through India and living in an Asian culture gave me a much broader cultural perspective, and I found that this sort of mechanistic atheist worldview was actually a rather provincial Western view, and I met plenty of intelligent people from different cultures who didn't share it, including Hindus and Buddhists and Muslims. That was the second stage, you know, broadening of perspectives. The third stage was taking psychedelics, which completely changed my view of the mind. Nothing in my scientific education prepared me for the effects of psychedelics like LSD, which I tried when I got back from Asia and I was in Cambridge. And so that made me think, and that got me interested in meditation. And so I started doing transcendental meditation and yoga, and was very drawn to the Hindu philosophy. It's one reason I took a job in India. So I went to India as an agricultural scientist. I worked in an agricultural institute for 5 years, improving Indian crops and tropical crops in general. And through being in India and getting in more and more of an appreciation of Hindu philosophy and culture, I came to the rather surprising realization that however hard I tried, I'd never be a Hindu. That really my own roots were Christian, and I turned back to a Christian path. And at that stage, I met Father Bede Griffiths, this wonderful holy man who really created a kind of bridge between East and West. He wrote a very good book called The Marriage of East and West. So I took some time off and lived in his ashram while I wrote my first book, A New Science of Life, which is dedicated to him. And so I found myself drawn back into the Christian tradition. And when I got back from India to England, it was like a tremendous rediscovery, finding my way home again. I'm a member of the Church of England, which is sort of halfway between Protestant and Catholic. It's similar to the Episcopalian Church in the U.S. And I don't find it a big strain or a problem being a Christian and a scientist. And when it comes to dogmatic thinking, within the Anglican Church, there's a tremendous broadness of thought, and I can say almost anything I want to people I know in the Anglican world, like in my parish church. But the minute I enter a scientific laboratory, I feel the shutters are going down. You know, that there's a kind of atmosphere of fear and intolerance, and you know there's these taboo topics like telepathy and stuff that you can't talk about very freely without people getting very uncomfortable. So my experience is that at least the parts of the Christian world I'm most familiar with are liberating, open, and enlivening, whereas the dogmatism of science I find deadening and very restrictive.
So, again, back to the whole idea of how knowledge often restricts us from discovering wisdom. What is the wisdom that you find that guides you? Is it faith, or is it what is it that when you wake up in the morning and you sit and you find a still place, and then there is still dogma there? What is it that calls to you and actually empowers your work about your Christian faith?
Well, as a practicing Christian, I pray every day, and I find that the practice of prayer is extremely helpful. It connects the events of my life, my daily life, my family, my friends, my work, things that are happening in the world, with a much larger perspective, a kind of the divine consciousness. So that's one thing that's really helpful in as a daily practice, in grounding, centering, connecting. I find meditation helpful as a way of centering, getting a sense of that calm and peace and connectedness. Both those things help. There are other different processes, I find, prayer and meditation, but both are incredibly helpful. And really, I suppose it's the what faith is not blind belief, but a kind of hope or trust that things will work out, that if one trusts in the best, that though bad things happen, there's always something good that can come out of situations. So it's really that looking on the bright side, taking a more positive and optimistic view. That's something, of course, that in America comes naturally to a lot of people. One of the remarkable contrasts between Britain and America, and when I travel between them every year, is that in Britain there's a high level of cynicism, despair, lack of faith. The percentage of people who have a religious practice in Britain is less than 10%, whereas in America it's the majority. There's a huge difference culturally between a country in which most people have some kind of faith, even if it's not within a formal church or institutional religion, and a world where, as in Britain, where most people don't have any faith. And it leads to a tremendous level of depression, despair, and cynicism. But I find this faith is really helpful in giving me a sense of hope and purpose. And I don't normally talk like this, I very rarely discuss my faith, but I have to say, since you asked me, that another aspect is that for me as a Christian, obviously the model of Jesus is a very important one, and I find him a really helpful role model. Jesus, after all, was not supporting the religious establishment of his time. He was a kind of rebel against it, a kind of heretic, and in relation to the world of science, I find he's a very powerful model for me. And, you know, he challenged the established dogmas. He tried to do things differently. It didn't bring him fame and fortune. On the contrary, it brought him to a sticky end. But I find that that model of dissent from dogma and orthodoxy is inherent in the Christian tradition, more so than other religious traditions. There's a kind of tension within Christianity between this kind of radical, rebellious desire for change and overthrow of an established order. And on the other hand, the institutional Christianity provides a kind of established order which actually all human beings need. So I think it's not so much that we need one or the other. I think we need both. And within the heart of Christianity, there's a great tension between those two strands, the anti-establishment and the establishment.
Yes, there definitely is. We're getting close to the end of our time. One of the things, to me, it seems like things are stacked in favor of an awakening of consciousness as you look in historically. My question to you in kind of a closing way is, where do you think consciousness itself is going? Can you say anything about that in relationship to the morphogenetic resonance and the fields?
Well, this is a bigger question about evolution and where we're all going, and I don't claim any prophetic powers, but I do think we're escaping from the dogmatism of the materialist phase that's dominated our culture for a long time. My own efforts are really devoted to trying to find both different theoretical models and experimental evidence. And given that we're nearing the end of the time, could I just ask listeners if they could actually help in this project, or at least help in my
absolutely
research?
Please do. By the way, well, I tried to do that experiment this morning, and on my Mac I couldn't get onto it, but the one that I think you're going to talk about, but please tell.
Oh, well, I hope there's not sometimes there are glitches, and if there are, I'll try and get them fixed. But
okay,
anyway,
I sent you that information.
Oh, okay. Well, if it doesn't work and anyone tries it, just try again after a few days. But what it is an audio precognition test. You listen to four different, there's four sound samples, and you have to guess which one you're going to hear. And then after you've guessed, it's randomly selected and you hear it. It may be a different one from the one you guessed. The question is, can you guess what's going to happen when no one in the world knows which you're going to hear? It sounds strange, counterintuitive, but this experiment so far is giving results way above chance. And what they show, if they're repeatable, is that our minds are connected to their own future as well as to their past through memory. We have a kind of link to our own future experience. And this is a very radical conclusion. The experiment's terribly simple. When it works, it's fun to do. So I'd like to invite people to try it out. If it doesn't work straight away, you know, have another go later. It's on my website, www.sheldrake.org, and it's called the Audio Precognition Test.
And it's I look forward to doing it again tonight. Maybe it was the early hour that I was working on it, too. But I just want to thank you, Rupert, for taking the time. I know it's late at night there in London to join us on Conversations here on KVMR. I know our listeners really appreciate your being here and the ongoing work and getting your perspective on the unfolding world that we live in.
Well, it's a great pleasure, Michael.
Hope to talk to you again soon.
Yes.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
So, Rupert Sheldrake, now we did our interview. Now it's your turn. Guess what it's time to do? What you do is you pick up the phone and you go over and you call 530-265-9555 or toll-free 1-800-355-5867 and you make that phone ring so that we can keep this station alive and bringing you people like Rupert Sheldrake and Father Descoto Brockman. So please go to the phone right now, 530-265-9555. Get your checkbook, 1-800-355-5867.
those are the numbers to call. And if that this past hour was important to you, and I suspect it was, hearing some of the extraordinary things that we just heard.